Welcome to Algorithmi and welcome Marci Nyman.
Thank you, Eero.
This is awkward. We are talking English, but this is the new line of the podcast. We want you to understand everything. How would you describe yourself to someone who is watching or listening this in Vanuatu? Or in Pyongyang, where you're big.
I'm big in Pyongyang. Big, yeah. I'd say I'm a music maker. I make music in different forms. I compose, I arrange, I play, I improvise, I sing. That's kind of very down-to-earth way of describing it, I think.
Because in Finland, you are more famous than Santa Claus, basically. Everybody knows you. But for someone abroad, if they want to check out your music now, right away, what is the first thing you recommend in YouTube or in Spotify?
Well, there's a pretty good recording of my violin concerto premiere from Tapiola Sinfonietta.
Ooh, I was there.
Oh, you were?
I was there at the general rehearsal. Yeah. Antti Tikkanen, right?
Yeah. Yes. Antti plays and Ryan Bancroft is conducting. And it's a pretty good, like, a multi-camera production.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
So that's one thing that I'd
the whole thing in YouTube.
The whole thing.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
And then probably I have two, like, solo albums.
Yeah.
First one is titled Marci, and second one is Kelluva Katedraali, a floating cathedral.
Okay.
And they are produced by me, and I've written all the music and the lyrics. And maybe those would be, like, the most personal items that I would offer.
I will link those two.
Amazing.
With this episode. Just go to the, you know, wherever you are watching or listening this, and you'll find the link, as well as you will find the link for the two things that are talking about. Jimi Hendrix, Machine Gun. First, I will Machine Gun interview you about Jimi Hendrix. When did you hear this for the first time, and how mind-blowing was it in the scale of 1 to 2? No, 1 to 100.
I'd say that when I was a young person starting to play the guitar, Jimi Hendrix wasn't appealing at all. I started out listening to blues music and B.B. King and Stevie Ray Vaughan, and then through the movie Crossroads, I got into Steve Vai and all kind of more acrobatic stuff. But I'd say that
how is Steve Vai in that movie? I mean, is he like in the role?
Yeah, he's got this big role in the ending. This Ralph Macchio, the Karate Kid actor,
Karate Kid guy, yeah.
And he's like a classical guitarist who wants to learn the blues. And in the end, there's it's like based on the myth of Crossroads, like Robert Johnson going to the crossroads and meeting the devil and trading his soul for this virtuosic playing. And then in the end, there's like devil and his advocate, or the player is played by Steve Vai, and then they are cutting heads, like battling.
Really?
Well, yeah, and it's really like...
I have to see this one. Okay.
Yeah. It's really cool. It's a legendary scene, and I think one of the things that Steve Vai is playing became a song in his... on his EP, Bad Horsey. And it's, I remember seeing that clip for the first time. I still can almost remember all the notes and everything.
Mm-hmm.
It was like mind-blowing. But Jimi Hendrix always was a tougher nut to crack, because he was sometimes out of tune, and on the album, sometimes the sounds wouldn't appeal to a young player like me.
Yeah.
But then I remember I was at a friend's house, junior high school, watching the Woodstock concert, and that blew me away. It was like a perfect Sunday morning. We were waking up after like a school party or something, and then we watched it, and kind of it really struck me the impressiveness. I mean, the
energy
and the amount of expression that is in his playing.
Yeah,
and I think it's at its most powerful form in the Machine Gun song, and it's also for me, it has to do with getting to know Raul Björkenheim.
Yeah,
and his fantastic Krakatau's live album, which for me is as good as the Band of Gypsies album that the Machine Gun is on. So, I kind of for me, the electric guitar is the most expressive instrument. I don't know what is Ilmaisuvoima in English, but the kind of the range of dynamics and the also the all the rock and roll symbolism and sexuality and
sexuality mentioned already.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And rebellion. And,
okay, you know, we're like getting warm.
Yeah. And then it became this like a anthem for me, the Machine Gun. It's something that I regularly listen to.
Okay.
Just to kind of remind me of how to hold on to one idea and just let the expression take care.
Before we go to the notated, transcribed PDF, which I have also linked, let me ask you a couple more things about Jim Hendrix. You are right when you're saying that you get most out of it live, you know, because there are several stories I've heard from various podcasts where, for instance, Paul McCartney and I think Eric Clapton, they still remember when they used to go to this small club, you probably know the name of the club, in London, where they hear for the first time this totally unknown guitar player who played there. And just this seems to be the key thing when people talk about Jim Hendrix, about the experience seeing him live.
Yeah, and I think that was captured in the Woodstock movie. So it became kind of worldwide thing, but the albums are great. Of course, Jimmy was also a virtuoso in the studio, using the stereo, which had just, you know, come up and all the effects, and it must have been a really psychedelic experience to put the headphones on and listen to those albums at first. But from the sheer like musician/guitarist viewpoint, I mean, the live things are.
Yeah.
And I've understood that he played really, really loud. And that's also like a physical experience that people hadn't experienced before.
Yeah. And unfortunately, we use the facts we know about Jim Hendrix are usually the he died young, alcohol, drugs, and you know the 27 club. But do you know anything about his kind of practicing years, his practicing routines or influences? Where did all those things came from?
Well, he played like in the. Is it called the Chilling Circuit, or the like? He played in this house band with different, like Little Richard, for example.
Okay.
He played with him and learned a lot from performing from him, and he used to tour a lot, like just playing many sets a night, and usually the effect of his playing, I've understood, was that at some point the bandmates were like, okay, that's a bit too much. Can you take it a bit easy?
Yeah.
But he had this like soul of like wanting to express much more than the like the time.
Yeah.
At the time you would see. So I think he practiced a lot on the road.
Okay.
But he was fascinated with the guitar from an early age. So.
Okay. Yeah.
I guess it was not like a.
It's a quite a leap from Joe Pass and Wes Montgomery and those guys.
Yeah,
even B.B. King, you know, who was before him. So, So he really invented a lot of new stuff.
Yeah, and guitar. Also like the technological stuff, like this fuzz pedals and wah-wah pedals and the certain Marshall amps were just coming up, and you could get these sounds that you couldn't before. So he kind of took those technological aspects and really played the shit out of them.
Are there good books about him? Have you read?
Yeah, and magazines. There's a lot of like information
on okay. it. And what were his demons? Why do you think he drank himself to death or, you know?
Yeah, whatever happened.
Yeah.
There was a lot of, I've seen this Stevie Ray Vaughan interview where he says that, I'm pretty sure that it was no accident. Like there was a lot of like conspiracy theories.
Oh, really?
Like, yeah.
Okay.
Because he was affecting so many people and a part of this like hippie peace movement. But I think it's...
Could be J. Edgar Hoover.
But probably from, you know, home, the parents.
Broken
he's written,
home.
Yeah, he's written a lot of beautiful stuff. A few, like I think Angel and Little Wing are about his mother. And I think there was the basic void that is like the common thing.
A lot
of substance users, like the void, has to be filled with something.
Well, before he left, he gave us a lot, you know. And before this chat, my knowledge of Jimi Hendrix has been limited. So that's why I'm asking all these questions. But I know Little Wing very well.
Yeah, we played it together.
We recorded it together. Yes, yeah. Such a beautiful song. So let's open this transcription, which is linked to this episode. I found this in the net of internet for free. It's transcribed by Andy Aledort. So our deepest thanks to Andy Aledort who gave us this transcription.
He's done an amazing job on it. It's precise.
This is the first question. I mean, is this... I have to
interrupt you, man.
Yeah.
Because I can't find the file here.
Oh, it's in the desktop. Let me see. It's here. No. Where is it?
It's nowhere to be found.
Let me see. We go here.
Muistiinpanot.
In. Yes.
Wonderful.
All right. My first question to you, my friend, is this what guitar solo transcriptions usually look like? I mean, to me, this looks like modern art. I mean, is this the way guitar solos look like? You got like, you know, all the fingerings or what are these?
It's not fingering, it's tablatures. So
tablatures.
You see this
six
lines, so that's the strings and the numbers are the frets.
Okay.
But this is like, I really have to raise my hat to Andy Aledort, because he's done an amazing job.
I mean,
it's so precise, and this is what it looks at its best, because every little thing, little nuance is written out, and I think this must have taken like a year to write.
Yeah, I think so too. And this is, I mean, you saw this first time yesterday when I. So you only been listening this before this. So what would you say for an upcoming young guitar player? Would you recommend to learn this note by note, or do you see some danger fields in that? Like I always say that transcribing Keith Jarrett or Chick Corea is very educative, but also very dangerous at the same time.
I think this for me wouldn't be the thing that I would start with. I mean, it's so specific, and so there's a lot of things going on that if you would play this like metrically, it wouldn't sound like it. So there's a lot
That's
of
right.
like a there's so much like old school like blues here, like really from the swamps.
Yeah.
You know, like so much of it has to do with the feel and having the sound in your ears and then trying to replicate it and not reading it from here. But for someone like me who's spent a lot of time with the guitar, this is really fascinating because you kind of, it's fun to watch this and combine the like the animalistic volcanic sounds of the track to this like very strict and very well written part.
What if we look at the first bar and there's the G on the beat of three? Is this a trill that he has written?
No, it's vibrato, I think.
Oh, vibrato. Yeah. Okay, that's a vibrato sign. And then if you look at bar six, it got those little small triangles. Is that like a?
That's a bend.
Oh, that's a bend.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is how to learn to read guitar transcriptions 101.
Yeah, but that's in a way it's fun that you mentioned it because those are kind of the two things that are very the electric guitars, like in the core, the bends and the vibrato. That's where you hear the player's soul or the player's like.
That's right.
There's a billion ways to bend a note.
Yeah.
Or play the vibrato. So it's kind of the very essence of guitar.
So
playing.
This starts with the intro, and then it goes to guitar solo right away. And
well, there's a verse sang. I think the solo is followed by the singing.
Yeah. Well.
You mean the short solo.
Yeah, that's true. I think his time feel is just magical.
Yes.
You know, in the intro you can sense it so well because there's no drums and it's just amazing time feel.
It's very soulful time feel.
Yeah.
And it's also fun to realize like almost all the bars, all the stuff is happening like on the 12th fret, which is the octave fret.
Yeah.
And that's the first thing when people learn to play like improvise the guitar, they start playing the E minor pentatonic and blues stuff.
Yeah.
And it's like the where everybody starts.
Yeah.
And then this whole track is basically just being played there on the like 12th fret position.
I'm showing if somebody is so lazy that doesn't want to open this transcription, I'm showing it to camera. This is what it looks like, you know. If you are a beginner with music, I would say go note by note, one note at the time.
Yes. One bar per day.
One bar per day. Okay. Is there a certain... Well, let me ask you this before we go into the licks. Does his singing blow you away in a similar way than his guitar playing?
Well, for me, it's like an extension.
Okay.
Of his playing. This is a perfect song for this discussion because he's pretty much playing what he's singing.
Yeah.
And that's kind of, for me, the old, very old style of blues playing.
Yeah.
Like with before the 12-bar blues.
Yeah.
Blues was just like, sang and it was rhythmically, jäsenelty. Like it was...
Organized
by the phrases that
blues
musicians would sing, and like doubling the singing with the playing is also the one of the key things in this song.
Yeah,
and it just gives this impression that he's really in the music and he's just expressing it because the singing and playing just go together and. It's so free.
Yeah. I'm at the same time. I'm giving a little sample from my iPhone of the intro. And now the machine gun. Thank you. and with the band. I think we are allowed to play this much in a podcast.
Yeah.
And if not, come to see me in the prison and put a pizza under the door. At least
with
on a file
yeah, baked into it.
Yeah. Yeah. What a track. What a track.
Yeah, the sound, and you know, it's one of those tracks that when you listen to it, you're instantly in the... I keep imagining the place and how yeah. it felt and how hot it was in there. And
that's right. And the place and the year was live at the Fillmore, and the year was 70, the year I was born.
Yeah, and I think it's like New Year's Eve or something.
Yeah, Fillmore East, 70. Wow. Okay. Something you want to point out or pick up in this... I think 20 pages of guitar madness, something that really sticks out to you.
Well, first I have to mention, of course, the cultural weight
okay.
of the piece, because it's in the beginning when Jimmy's speaking, introducing the song, he says, I want to dedicate this to all the soldiers fighting in the civil rights fights, and oh yeah, and all the people fighting in Vietnam. And then it's like it's a pun a bit, but in this song there's so much of this, like the machine gun, the sounds of machine guns, sounds of bombers, the sounds of bombs falling in the end, and like explosions, and the kind of violence is all the time there. And it's an amazing combination of like this pacifist or this peace.
So he was political.
Yeah.
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 Okay.
And it's the same thing happened in Woodstock when he played the Star Spangled Banner with all the dive bombs.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
All that stuff. So.
Interesting fact, you can hear the opening speak about the Vietnam War in Spotify, but in YouTube,
no
introduction. It starts with the music.
Yeah, there's like this one neat thing that just a small... a particular detail that
yes.
Raoul Björkenheim told me that there's a little bit of Vietnamese kind of folk music vibes here in the intro and in the ending.
Mm-hmm.
Like Jimmy had been listening to some Vietnamese music, and there's yeah. this like, I think in the end you can hear it better, but there's these slides and this
yeah.
kind of like some trying to imitate a traditional
yeah.
instrument. And that gives it like a magical flavor.
See, he also hits the major third sometimes. It's not yeah. all in E minor.
And that's like for me, that's the traditional blues
yeah.
approach.
Yeah.
Like, and all those bends, the blue notes and everything, it's a straight line from the first blues musicians to this. But, and for me, he's playing like the very basic blues things, but in a way that it sounds like space music or ageless
yeah, yeah, yeah.
music.
Yeah, yeah.
So it has a lot of like grit, and the roots of it are very deep in the crown. But he, especially when the real guitar solo starts with the searing high note that seems yeah. to sustain forever. That's
bar 66.
Yeah, that's yeah. one of my favorite
yeah.
moments in recorded history.
Wow, yeah, and he really holds that note.
Yeah, and
yeah,
the
yeah.
univibe pedal, which
that's
makes
right.
this wah, 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 small.
But I mean, but I meant when I was talking about the major third that, I mean, this has the minor blues vibe
yeah.
all over it. And in minor blues, you don't really play the major third so,
yeah,
so
but in,
often.
Yeah, for me, in that kind of, like in that really... deep blues tradition, you kind of bend the minor a little bit up, and it's just fits perfectly.
Okay,
like in the guitar playing.
I do that on my
yeah.
next gig. Yeah,
yeah.
Let's see how Footprint sounds with
yeah.
Lots of E.
Well,
yeah.
if you play it, it's gonna sound beautiful.
No. This bar 80, 81, 82. I mean, that's one of the lick that sticked out to me when I was listening this.
Yeah.
So you used to go through this with your teacher Raul Björkenheim?
Not like this.
Okay. I mean,
we just talk about it, and he had this idea. It's like this is as good as the best John Coltrane in a way that you create this long sphere, like this very long arc.
Yeah.
That's really based on the amount of like harmonic ideas is very small,
yeah,
very limited.
Yeah.
But still it's evolving always, and like really staying in that one idea, in that one kind of mood.
Yeah.
And that's, for me especially, it's very hard to kind of create this like 5-minute solo, just one chord.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is like more, you know, playing like model things. If you have just one chord, it's very difficult to create this tensions, and especially because harmonically there's not a lot of like tension and release. He doesn't go to like, you
it's
know,
a one chord wonder.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's sheer expression for me. That's something that is from the other side of the brain.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, it's very hard to pick, you know, a bar.
Yeah.
Can you see what he's doing right
in
here?
In G, it says third guitar solo. Well, that's, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, and in the end, if it goes into this like a very just noise, and I think that's the most cinematic part of the song. Like you really see this napalm falling.
Yeah.
From the sky, and it's.
But technically, if we're talking just like guitar technique, this is probably not in the high end of technical stuff. I mean, I've heard Steve Vai and those guys play much faster. It's more like the energy and the stamina.
Yeah, and the sound and the kind of. I mean, nobody could get that sound from the guitar, and you can hear it like he has these Marshalls behind him, and there's this like 1 million horsepowers that he's kind of controlling like with his fingers, and there's like this huge amount of volcanic energy going through this very small hole.
Yeah.
And how he uses the feedback, and when the guitar starts to feedback, that is in a way a technique.
Yeah.
But, you know, as far as like advanced, you know, picking stuff, this is not from the
most hard,
athletic
department
of guitar
playing. Yeah, Alan Holsford, those guys, yeah.
But it's, you know, almost impossible to make the guitar sound like that.
Yeah. What is the one thing you could really learn from this? As a young musician, is it
just the idea of like how to create a long solo that's interesting without having to kind of resort to going to a different key or having like a lot of weird notes.
Yeah.
And of course, like, don't underestimate the, like, I mean, it's, for me, it's the most old school thing is to have the Marshall turned up and have a Stratocaster and this fuzz phase, and but it's such a powerful weapon for me, in my, you know, books.
Yeah. Who do you think that who are the follow-ups of Jimi Hendrix in the guitar world? Who do you think that took the very best of him and use it in a good way?
It's a good question. For me, Raul Björkenheim is the only player who makes me feel like that.
Yeah.
I have to go back to the Alive, the Krakatau album. Mm. That from the like the first note, it has this same sheer, like you get the, you start to taste the blood in your mouth, and I would say, because he's such an impossible player to imitate.
Yeah.
And make it your own.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, like his music, his songs, I've been playing a lot of gigs, like playing Hendrix music,
yeah,
and making my own versions, as we did with your trio. That compositions are so open and so like perfect that it's very easy to just take them. Like he would do these versions, like we all know the All Along the Watchtower, which for Bob, I've read somewhere that Bob Dylan, even when he heard it, he couldn't play the same way again ever because it made such an impact on him. And I think that you were talking about the Beatles going to see Hendrix.
Yeah,
I think Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Band was released on Thursday.
Mm.
And on Saturday, Jimmy had a concert in London and all the Beatles were there. And they started the concert with the Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. And they were like flabbergasted. I mean, how could they learn that song?
Okay.
It just came, the record came out three days ago.
Yeah.
And then they were already playing it. So he used to make versions of the music. So in a way, he's such a welcoming musician to aspire to. Like his songs are you're very welcome to play them because I played everybody else's music.
Yeah.
And it's easy to, you know, Purple Haze is one of the most popular first songs to learn on the electric guitar. Mm-hmm. Especially when I was growing up, people would find that Hendrix chord.
The
plus nine chord.
Yeah. I've seen somewhere Mike Stern, the Jimi Hendrix of jazz. You know, I've seen this.
Oh, yeah. So yeah, that's good. That's what Miles would say to him
when
they were playing. Like, play more like Jimmy, man.
Yeah.
Turn it up, man.
Actually, yeah, in Miles' book by Ian Carr, you can read that Miles wanted to work with Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah.
Never happened. And then a decade later, he also wanted to work with Prince.
Oh, yeah.
Never happened.
Yeah.
Too bad. I would have wanted to hear those
collaborations. I think, you know, Tony Williams was up for the drummer in that Hendrix session.
Yeah.
That would have been pretty amazing to hear.
Really? On the early ones?
Yeah.
Or, okay.
I mean, it was like the idea that it would be Miles and Tony Williams and Jimmy and I don't know who. But it never happened.
Well, at least they talked about
it.
Yeah. Anything else about the solo, or shall we go?
Maybe we should go. I mean, it's there for everybody to enjoy, and it's amazing that you found this transcription.
Yeah, it is amazing what you find at the internet. There was actually many of those. This was the only one for free.
Oh yeah.
But from MuseScore, you could get it $5 or something like that. Now something completely different.
Oops, I just kicked the camera.
That's nothing. You're in the picture. Yeah, smile. You're on camera. Okay.
The Prokofiev
from Jimi Hendrix to Sergei Prokofiev. Can you find it?
Yeah.
You found it. Okay. And now we are reading the score from the Petrucci Music Library, also known as imsl.org. But let's talk about Prokofiev first. Born in Ukraine, 1891. And you probably know this, he died on the same day than Josef Stalin.
Yeah.
The 5353. A dictator that he hated, like most of the artists in the Soviet Union, who also put his wife to Siberia, you know, for the, you know, last year. So and he happens to die on the same day that everyone were supposed to moan for this dictator who killed millions of people. And it's so sad. But this is a little bit like Murphy's Law, because I think that Prokofiev was always under his peers. you know, we have many stories of Tchaikovsky. We have many stories, even Shostakovich, who looked like a rock, you know, I mean, the total stone face, and he didn't speak. We have many stories of Stravinsky and Maurice Ravel and Debussy. There's so few things we know about Prokofiev. Or have you been digging into his life?
Not really. A musician friend of mine wrote this like essay about his like different compositional styles or aspects of it. But you know, I really haven't. I read this one book at our mutual friend's Pekka Kuusisto's house. That was a correspondence between him and
Diaghilev?
No, movie director.
The Russian one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Eisenstein.
Eisenstein.
Yeah. Okay. I have to check that out. If somebody knows good books about Sergei Prokofiev, send me a message.
Yeah.
Or come to the podcast and tell me everything about him, because I would love to know more about him. Well, we all know that he was raised in Ukraine. He went to St. Petersburg. He was a prodigy, a master pianist, mm-hmm. and his early works are even the first symphony, the classical one, which I love.
Mm.
It's in the spirit of Haydn, and he was just so accomplished guy. Incredible talent. And then he moved abroad. I think he lived in Paris. He worked with Sergei Diaghilev, Ballet Russeau. He went to United States, and at some point he got homesick.
Mm.
And I think he regretted it that he went back to his home country, which was now run by Joseph Stalin. Who was really neurotic with all the composers. And like I said, he put his wife in Siberia in the prison. And then, you know, the last years of Prokofiev were quite terrible, actually. Mm. So, but we love his music. Yeah. I mean, he really sticks out.
One of the conductors, I forget which one, said that conducting in Russia, when they start to talk about the Russian composers, they all love Stravinsky and Shostakovich and Mussorgsky and everybody. But when they start to talk about Prokofiev, everybody, he was the man. I mean,
he
enjoys this popularity among musicians everywhere.
Yeah. Even the Rubinstein books that I've read so many times, there are many stories about Stravinsky and all these guys who lived that time, but only one little story about Prokofiev. They run into each other in a music shop in New York.
Oh, yeah.
So then nobody's telling anything. But
buying guitar picks, probably.
Yeah, of course. but I think these are the must hear compositions of Prokofiev. You have to check out the first symphony, the classical symphony, the second violin concerto, especially the second movement. I think it's one of the best melodies ever written.
Yeah, I know you love it.
I know, I love it. And the most magical key change from E flat major to B major, right in the beginning, I mean, it's goosebumps.
Romeo and Juliet, of course.
Romeo and Juliet, many people know that, as well as Peter and the Wolf. Mm. Those are the most famous one. I think the piano sonatas 6 and 7 are incredible. That's why I placed the piano sonata book right behind Marsi. Vision Fugitives, pardon my French, but that's a really good piano book. And
there's also a string version of it.
Yes. And I keep wondering why his opera, The Love for Three Oranges, is so seldom performed. Mm. I would travel to Ulaanbaatar to see it, but it's never played, you know. So come on, opera houses, little less of Wagner and more Prokofiev. Also, his first piano concerto is very often played, very neat piece, and everybody are foaming about his third piano concerto. But you, my friend, you picked the second piano one, yeah. concerto. Why?
Well, I, in my teens, a friend persuaded me to come to an orchestral camp
okay.
here in Finland, in Orivesi.
Yeah.
Like a legendary orchestral camp that lasted for, I think, 2.5 weeks or something. And he said that you should come and play some percussion there just to hang out. It's a great way to spend the summer. And I said, I never played percussion. And yeah, it doesn't matter. Just lie something on the form that you've played. And then I went, and it was a life-changing experience. I met so many great orchestral players that I play with nowadays, and Pekka Kuusisto I met, and Arttu Takalo, and my best man Tatu Förtjen, and I fell in love with orchestra music there.
Yeah,
they played, I think, Arttu Takalo's first orchestral piece, and Arttu was carrying around the score, and he would show me like stuff how to orchestrate, and I was immediately like drawn to that.
Yeah.
The scores.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The studying of those. And then I went to listen to Kalle Toivio played this.
Really? Okay.
Hannu Lintu was conducting. And the first rehearsal that I heard these opening bars, it was something that I never heard before. I mean, it had so much of what I had grown to love in music, but
yeah.
so much something that I never heard and unfamiliar. And still to this day, like I was just playing through the few of the first systems
yeah.
this morning, and all that, like you were talking about the modulation there on the violin concerto, but the way this harmony moves for me is mind-blowing.
I mean,
if you would arrange this a bit differently, it could be like on a way shorter album or something. Because the melody is kind of like a, it has this like a modal quality.
That's right.
Kind of like a very cool way to begin. But then, and the chords, like there's this 2-5 situation here in.
Which bar?
There's no bar numbers.
No, there's no bar numbers. Which page? The second page is 100.
101.
Yeah.
The second system, like where the piano is on by itself.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like this.
It goes from key to key.
Yeah.
Yeah.
G minor 7 and then C 7 with, you know, what do you call it? Sharp 11 or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And all those. And that one modulation also there.
And this is one thing with Prokofiev. You never know where it's going. And some of his melodies, not in the Classical Symphony or Peter Wolf, but most of his melodies are like, I think Jerry Seinfeld would say, really? It's like, was that a mistake? I mean, it's like... It sounds like that he, in purpose, he put some wrong-sounding note, and it's so intriguing and so interesting.
Yeah, for me, this, like the beginning, the piano melody is something very personal for him also. It has this weird quality of like coolness and tension. It's really... And where the strings come in, like page 100, the second bar, this pattern that just spreads out through the strings, the high strings.
And the piano part, so difficult.
Yeah.
So difficult. One more time, I refer to Arthur Rubinstein, who played the shit out of Rachmaninoff. I mean, he played the Rachmaninoff concertos all the time. But then he said in his book that Prokofiev, that was the limit.
Yeah.
So he played all this shit at his house, but he never performed, not even the piano sonatas. Mm. So for me, that says that this is more difficult than Rachmaninov, which is very difficult. But
Yeah, I heard like, 50 versions of it.
Yeah.
I think Yuya Wang is the master of like being on top of the cadenza with like 2 billion different directions. And there's gear number 8 here. Let's go to gear number 9.
She's fantastic. I was listening Yevgeny Kissin recording.
Oh.
Pretty good. I mean, at least he tried. Yeah. So the second movement, which is, I put the pages here. Second movement starts at the 1-3-6. And believe it or not, I heard it first time in preparation for this, our little chat.
Oh, okay.
This is totally new for me. I've checked the first one and the third one. But this second movement, 16 notes only.
Yeah, both hands.
Or did you want to talk about the cadenza of the first
no,
part? No, okay, let's go cool. to the second cool. second movement, because these GoPros will blow up after 1 hour and 50 minutes. we have limitations here. Yeah, the second movement, 16 notes with the right hand. All the time. I mean, so difficult, so furious, so virtuotic.
Yeah.
What have you learned in terms of orchestration from Prokofiev? A little middle question here. Yeah. Because once we talked about this, we were talking about orchestration, and you said that listen the Fifth Symphony. Of Prokofiev, you recommended that for me, especially the use of woodwinds.
Yeah, I studied the Romeo and Juliet score.
Yeah,
a lot, and like the woodwind doublings, and like just when they double the violins, and when not, and which ones do, and of course there's a lot of like a amazing harp writing there.
Yeah,
like these really thick chords from the bottom register and doubling the brass, and it's Runsaud and Saarvi, you know, it's like
this
gift that keeps on giving.
Yeah.
That score.
Yeah.
And there's so much of everything is just in a perfect place and in a perfect balance for me.
Yeah. I just correct one thing. I was looking at the wrong page earlier. The scherzo. Yes, it is 60 notes with both hands all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I don't want to have hate mail because of that. So now I have the right pages here.
Beautiful. That's beautiful.
It's, one note at the time. Note at the time.
It's like a massive piece, but there is this one prize waiting at the end, which is in the fourth movement. Let's see if we can find the bar.
The fourth movement, is it intermezzo or finale?
The finale.
207, so just scroll down. I think the pianist's nightmare regarding the 16th note thing is that you're performing it, it's the full hall, it's probably a live broadcast. And in the third bar, you feel your hands are getting into cramp. And you have, that's...
Yeah, and I think the sec...
207 is the finale.
Okay. Like, not the last, but...
Oh,
the bar before the last, in that second part, there's this repetition of...
Yeah.
Of the same key, which is a nice surprise in the end.
Yeah. Okay, scrolling. This is good content. This is good content. The two guys scrolling.
We're going to have like a reaction to Iron Marcy scrolling.
Yeah. The scrolling continues. Where are we? Now I'm in 198. Where are you?
I'm just looking for the...
Don't go to my page history.
Here we go. It's page 228.
228. All right. Getting near.
The rehearsal number 100.
Yes.
That's...
No. I'm on page 226, and there's a rehearsal number 103. Are we on internet?
Oh, that's 223. Sorry, I thought
that was 2 to 3. Eight. Okay, yeah.
That's a funny coincidence.
Yeah,
the 3 looks so much like 8.
Yes, I know it's a small. Yeah. All right. So da 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 da. Yeah, that one. So that is that a folk melody?
Yeah, I think.
Yeah.
And it's like...
Well, this is very common for Russian composers. I mean, it was after I heard The Rite of Spring and Petrushka for many times, I learned that most of the melodies
you are the originals.
That and the most famous melodies of Rite of Spring, that was from Petrushka, but... Yeah. Folk songs that Igor Stravinsky took.
Mm.
And yeah, but this...
It's a beautiful melody. Also, like, pianistically, I mean, I'm not a fantastic pianist, but I love how this kind of expands.
Yes.
Like, there's a new voice comes in.
Those half notes.
Yeah.
I was
long interval. Like
exactly the same reaction when I was listening to this. It's always magical when you create something that sounds like played with three hands.
Yeah, that's
three
true.
Hands, yeah. Or with the Seppo Hovi style. Okay, let's not go into that. That's too inside. But I had to. Did you actually play the percussion on this at the camp?
No. I think there's only like...
You were drinking beer that time.
Yeah, we played the... I think we played Pines of Rome Respighi thing.
Okay.
There was a lot of percussion.
Yeah.
But it was an amazing experience to be at the first time in the orchestra. I remember... Like the first rehearsal, Hannu Lind was conducting, and I had no idea how to play percussion. And my dear friend, my big brother, Arto Takala, would just come behind me and give me a mallet and say, okay, now you hit this part of the drum. 1, 2, 3, now. Okay, that's good. A bit louder next time. And then like really hands-on way to. And then when I started to get the hang of it, it was the perfect place to watch the orchestra, like
from the
back row, you can see everything, and you see how people interact with each other, and it's just like a perfect viewpoint for
it. It is, and you really learn how to count rests.
Yeah, that's true.
As a percussionist,
because if you play the triangle in the wrong place, it's gonna be heard.
Yeah. No triangle in a wrong place. Yeah.
But it's a huge song. I mean, so many beautiful passages here. For me, this melody that we just talked about, then the beginning.
Yeah.
They are the two things that still move me.
Yeah.
The most.
So you come back to this piece once in a while, listen to it, and Do you sometimes open the score when you listen it? Or
Yeah, sometimes. I think I stole that, the beginning, the... expanding strings thing to some of my arrangements, just changing the key and a little bit of the notes, but it's like this chromatic of like melting.
Yeah,
this thing is melting on top of the music, and it's so cool.
I think Prokofiev was particularly great with the clarinet through his. I can't find it now, but the clarinet triplets going down. It's in one of the beginnings of one. I can't find it now, but
Yeah. We'll edit it.
Okay, let's close Prokofiev. Everybody can study it at home with their free time.
Exactly.
And this is this library I was talking about, this Petrus Library, is really cool. It could be a new thing for many people. I think it's Canadian-based music library where you can download scores and also not only orchestra scores, but just parts of different instruments.
Mm.
Well, you can subscribe and be a monthly donor.
Recommended,
or you can do it for free. But every composer that has been dead for 70 years is there, or 50 years?
I'm not sure.
I'm not sure. Yeah. So, but all this old stuff is there for everybody. If you just want to look at some piece, I think it's really neat. If you really are gonna get into it, go to the local sheet music store and buy the score. And support.
But it's cool to see, like, if you want to just hear like take 10 classical hit songs, like Mozart or some opera or whatever, and then you can kind of just glance through them and see how differently people have written in times. And like you take Benjamin Britten's Serenade, and then you see like very detailed notation, and then you take Bach or whatever, and then you see it's like just the notes, and then you kind of also realize the tradition of performing it and all of that.
And then if you get more into it, buy the sheet music and support the music publisher, because we need music publishers.
That's true.
Also.
That's true.
Okay, what are you working on right now?
I'm writing these arrangements for Avanti, Finnish chamber orchestra, and Maria Ylipää's Piazzolla thing. We're going to do a few concerts in the beginning of the year 2024. Just like I think it's 10.
When this is coming out. Yeah, exactly.
And probably we're going to perform it in the summer in the Avanti Suvisoitto Festival.
Okay.
Just an extension of the work we've done with the Piazzolla band.
Yeah.
Just the one where Jaakko
was. Yeah. The smaller Piazzolla.
Yeah. But now we're going to have like this, I think, 10-person string group.
Are you going to blow in some new air for Libertango?
Yes. You know, in fact, I did this.
Everybody's playing. Oh, it's always Libertango.
Yeah. Yeah, we recorded it, and I took the Libertango to transcribe Jaakko's violin solo for all the violin players.
Okay.
So it's going to be nice to hear.
All right. I think people listening, watching this abroad, probably doesn't know many things about the musician life in Finland.
Mm.
But I think, and I'm sure you're going to agree with me, the cool thing here is that you get to work in so many genres.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think if we would be in Hollywood, and if we would be known as this is the guy who makes good string arrangements for a romantic comedy, I think we would be doing those string arrangements for the rest of our lives.
Yeah, you'd have to find a, is it niche or niche?
Yeah,
niche,
yeah.
Like your own, like, specialty.
But in Finland, we are so versatile because we have to kind of get to know different styles and different music.
Just to make a living.
Yeah, just to make a living. Yeah. And you know, there's a guy. There are guys and gals here who can make as good string arrangement, you know, in the morning before they take the morning shit. You know, and then they do maybe game music or some hard rock, or they teach and they have a gig and, you know, maybe a podcast.
Yeah.
But
it's the most beautiful thing, because it's all about the community. For me, it's becoming more and more clear and important that music is about creating a community. And in Finland, it's a beautiful community, because I used to say that we would all, at the end of the day, would sit in the same bar, just close by here in the Manala bar.
But yes, it's called Manala. And if you go there around 3 a.m., you can see pile of people lying in the
But that's of course changed a bit, because nobody goes out anymore. But But for me,
except that, you,
yeah. I try to keep the flag up.
All right.
Just to share the secrets, and you can just go over to somebody from a totally different background and ask,
yeah,
"Hey, how do I write music for French horn? Can you tell me?" And,
yeah, sure.
Yeah. While you're at it, can you recommend some good music? And it's so easy to find information from the players, which I think is the best source of information.
Yeah, yeah. So your work with Tapiola Sinfonietta continues, also Espoo Big Band.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, and Avanti, as you just said.
Yeah, and there's a lot of, like, I'm trying to move more to the composition and try to stay at home with the kids as much as possible. But also it's something that draws me, like, strongly, intuitively, that I want to create new music and maybe make some albums, because this is the perfect time to release some albums of music.
Of course.
But I've been dreaming of this, like, guitar album, like instrumental guitar album for a while. And
you're also more and more conducting. Can we see in the future, like, a basic symphony evening conducted by you? Is that something
Not in the near future, at least.
No?
I'm going to do the Helsinki City Orchestra Vappu concert.
Oh, okay.
And there I'll be conducting the Wagner piece that is always in the beginning.
Okay. They have Wagner in the Vappu concert.
Yeah, it's the Lohengrin thing.
And that's the first thing comes to mind when you think of the May Day.
Yeah, but it's
May
been
Day.
There, I think, from the beginning. It's a tradition.
Okay. And it's not Tannhäuser Overture, no.
No, it's the Lohengrin.
Okay.
And then in the end there's Porilaisten Marssi.
Okay,
then,
okay.
Then Unto Tango. That's like everything else is then designed by me.
I would love to hear a concert conducted by you, maybe something so basic than G minor symphony of Mozart or the seventh symphony of Sibelius. What you make out of those, you know?
Well, I would really have to spend time studying the arts, because I've been usually just conducting my own music, so it's for me, then I'm granted the permission to do it because I've written the music.
How
it goes, but I have absolutely no chops yet to do anything like that. But I'm flattered that you said that.
Yeah. Have you ever suffered of unemployment, or have you been totally booked all your life?
There's been times that kind of looking at the bank account and the calendar, and it doesn't really match, like. There's been times when I've taken some time off, of course, and composing something requires.
Yeah.
Like nowadays, when I know that, like in the beginning of this year, 2024, I have 2.5 months of composing, and I've gathered some money, like last year's end, just to, so that I don't have to worry about it, but.
I know you told me before this, your bank account is actually now full.
Yeah.
You got the call from the bank that...
Whoa. No more.
So you either open a new account, because this current one is full.
Exactly.
Yeah, we can't fit any more cash there.
Musicians' basic problems.
Yeah. I'm sorry that you have to deal with this kind of practical problems.
In Finland, we have this... problems.
Come to Finland, be a musician. Has the world become a better place or a worse place during your lifetime?
Both. Very much better. Very much better. But of course, planet is gonna burn up. So it's like a huge thing. The climate. We didn't worry about it of that when I was a kid. Mm. We had the nuclear war to worry about.
Yeah.
But of course, poverty is decreasing all the time. And as we were talking about before this recording, that young people are smarter and they have better connection to their emotional life.
Mm.
And in Finland, I mean, equality is rising. But there's always a threat or new bad thing raising its head. So I think both. It's just like the nature of life.
Mm-hmm.
I think somebody said pretty wisely about technology, that when technology goes forward, it's a trade. Like when letters and post was invented, you would trade in long journeys to a friend's house.
Yeah.
And when telephone was invented, you traded in the romantic feeling of writing letters.
Yeah.
And with the iPhone, with the iPad, you kind of lose something
yeah.
as you gain like a technological
yeah.
advancement. So that's a one way of looking at it.
Yeah.
We keep trading things
yeah, yeah, yeah.
for others.
I think people are basically greedy and lazy. I mean, that's what we see. We want more and more and more, and with the less energy. That's why we have all this technology. But then we're also very, very brilliant in innovations. And I think when we hit the point that we have to save, when the shit really hits the fan, that we really have to save this planet with the technological innovations, I think that speeds up the innovation part because that's where the real money is.
Yeah.
So the greediness comes into that package. That now who is the one who invents, you know, the thing that cleans the air or you know, and then, you know, he gets the money. I think
yeah, and I think it's like,
but I don't want to see that situation.
I think
but we are going
it's
towards
like a
it.
Scale thing that when the scale tips that there's more money in the environment than
yeah.
than the fossil fuels,
yeah.
then it's gonna.
That's right, and that has been the talk of, you know, late months. That,
yeah.
yeah. Okay, what really, really pisses you off? What makes you really angry?
I don't know. Injustice, probably. I mean, is it if it's like you see somebody getting credit for other people's jobs, or somebody there's so much injustice in the world.
Yeah.
From the small scale of, hey, you're getting paid more than, or to the like consuming.
Yeah.
All this stuff while people are dying in sweatshops or whatever. That's. But anger is a fuel for action also.
Yeah, it is. What happens after you die?
Oh man, I think to me or
to you.
Well, I'm a Christian. I believe in the afterlife in the kind of this Christian terms. So I'm hoping to see some cool people or be encountered by beautiful souls like Jimi Hendrix and Prokofiev and my grandparents, and that's like a naivistic, beautiful picture that I have.
We see you there.
You will see.
At the bar. Yeah. There is a bar.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Thank you, Martin.
Thanks.